Good afternoon. This is a meeting of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. We are here pursuant to DC Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 and its amendments. It is Tuesday, September 29, 2013. We are seated in the Commission's hearing room at 441 4th Street Northwest in room 1140B. We are seated today as a commission of two persons, which is sufficient for a quorum. To my right is Commissioner Claudia McCoy, and I am Commissioner Ronald Young. We have one case notice for hearing this afternoon. The case number is RHTP072898 regarding the property located at 1512 21st Street Northwest, Unit 2. The parties are Thomas Evincy, the tenant appellant, and the estate of Lewis H. Kurt et al., the housing provider appellee. The commission knows that there are parties seated before us and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Bernard A. Gray, Sr., and I represent the tenant appellant.
Thank you, sir. And you, sir?
Good afternoon. Richard Bianco. I represent the housing provider, appellee in this case.
Thank you. The hearing is being recorded, so please speak up and into the microphones. We also ask that you turn off any communication devices which might interrupt the hearing. Before I get started with the details of the hearing and how we conduct it, the commission would like to take this time to provide the parties with an opportunity to consider settlement on this case. In settling this case, both parties can avoid the cost of litigation and further pursuit of their individual claims and counterclaims. In addition, if the parties are able to settle today, they can avoid the difficulties and delays inherent in the administrative and judicial process by arriving at a mutually acceptable compromise. The Commission has consistently stated that settlement in lieu of litigation is to be encouraged. We have at your disposal our settlement officer, Ms. Dorothy Greer, who will work with both parties to bring about a mutually satisfactory agreement. Is there any possibility of settlement, gentlemen?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
I don't believe so either.
Okay. The tenant appellant bears the burden of persuasion in this hearing. The tenant appellant will have 20 minutes to make argument to the commission. The tenant appellant may reserve 5 minutes to offer rebuttal to the argument of the housing provider appellee. The housing provider appellee will have 20 minutes to make argument to the commission, but will not have an opportunity for rebuttal. The members of the commission reserve the right to ask questions of either party during argument, and we will attempt to make sure that you get your full time in your arguments. Please confine your arguments to the record from below. No new evidence will be accepted at the hearing. Unless requested by the commission, we will not accept post-hearing briefs. We would like to begin with the tenant appellant first asking whether or not there are any preliminary matters. Sir.
No preliminary matters, sir.
In which case, Mr. Gray, you can begin at 10 minutes after 2.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This tenant petition was filed in June 22, 2007, naming as the party the estate of Lewis H. Kerr and Eleanor F. Kerr, personal representative of the housing provider. The tenant petition sought damages for rent increase, indicating the rent increase was larger than the amount of the increase, which was allowed by any applicable provision of the Act. A proper 30-day notice of rent increase was not provided before the rent increase became effective. The housing provider failed to file the proper rent increase form with the Rental Accommodation and Conversion Division. The rent being charged exceeded the legally calculated rent ceilings for our unit, and the rent ceiling filed with the Rental Accommodation Conversion Division was improper, or is improper, because it never was properly filed. The building in which the unit was located was not properly registered with the Rental Accommodations Office. After several continuances and a motion to dismiss filed by the housing provider, the hearing was held on November 3rd, 2010. Those continuances were, I think, legitimate. In fact, one of them was caused because I was ill. The attorney for the housing provider appeared without his client on the November 3rd, 2010 hearing. The hearing went forward. After the petitioner had completed examination of the petitioner, the housing provider counsel began the cross-examination on subjects not related to the subject matter that was the examination was placed on, and not even relevant to the allegations in the tenant petition. After the subject of taxes came up, the housing provider's counsel moved for a continuance in order to issue a subpoena for tax records. The court continued the hearing, and I believe it was over my objections, since there was no one there to represent the housing provider except for the counsel. The tenant petition had shown the increases was not valid, 30-day notice was not provided, the rent increases forms were not filed, the rent charge exceeded the legal rent charge, and the housing provider was not properly registered. There was no evidence to dispute the testimony of the petitioner. I know this commission has ruled that on the issue of when a hearing cannot be continued. However, I was not able to find the case. In this case, when the housing respondent did not show, the cross-examination did not address the subject matter discussed on examination, and the housing provider's counsel wanted to subpoena records that had nothing to do with the issues, this hearing should have been over and a ruling made shortly thereafter. Instead, it was continued again and again, and then the administrative law judge ruled that they were not able to subpoena the tax records, and therefore all that time was wasted. At the time the petition was filed, the personal representative, Eleanor F. Curry, was collecting rents on behalf of the estate of Lewis H. Curry. The tenant petition indicated the housing provider as the estate of Lewis H. Curry, Ellen F. Curry, personal representative, PR. The housing provider's counsel appeared and represented himself as the counsel for the housing provider. At the hearing on November 3rd, 2010, counsel appeared and cross-examined the petitioner. The housing provider was not there. Counsel was not located in any cases that states upon the death of the PR, the successor PR has to be reserved and named as representative of the petitioner. Nor was counsel able to locate any D.C. Court of Appeals cases that states if a party passes 2 years after the case has been heard, the PR dies, the case is dismissed. There is no evidence in the record to support the administrative law judge's conclusion that the personal representative was deceased. Nor that the state was closed at the time of the hearing on November 3rd, 2010. The fact is that there is no evidence in the record that the PR has actually deceased. There is only a statement by counsel that she died in 2012. And there's black letter law that states statements made by counsel are not evidence. So the record is void of any real evidence that the decedent had, in fact, deceased. We think the administrative law judge erred when she ruled on issues without allowing the parties to the opportunity to discuss it. But on those issues, we will pass on because we did discuss everything that she reversed at the time she issued the order. For instance, she had ruled that we were allowed to amend the tenant petition to include the trust. In her final ruling, she reversed herself without even telling us that that reversal was going to occur. And I submit to the commission that the errors in this case suggest that it should be remanded to the Office of Administrative Hearing for a final decision and order based on the hearing that was conducted on 2012, November 3rd, 2010. Thank you.
Commissioner McCoy, do you have any questions?
I'll wait.
Mr. Bianco. I'm sorry, Mr. Gray has additional 5 minutes before we vote.
Sure. The housing provider's position in this matter, I think, was very well articulated by the administrative law judge below, and I think the instructions at the outset of this hearing are also helpful to our case, that the tenant bears the burden of persuasion, and in this case, it's not a burden that they can carry. Mr. Gray's first objection to the findings below is that a continuance was wrongfully granted of the November 2010 hearing. We don't think that's relevant to the ultimate issue for a couple of reasons. One, at the time the November of 2010 hearing was adjourned, the housing provider had two pending motions to dismiss, and those two pending motions to dismiss had not been addressed at that time, and in fact had not been addressed until the judge's most recent order. That's the subject of this appeal. Following the November of 2010 hearing, there were two more evidentiary hearings. The last one in 2014, following the judge's ruling that the petition could be amended. With regard to the issue of the two real substantive issues that are on appeal here, the first being, was the trust ever a proper party, and the second being whether dismissal is appropriate as to the estate, I'd like to take up the issue of the trust first, because I think it's the simplest issue. The trust isn't a proper party to this case, and I think the reason why the trust isn't a proper party to this case is very simple. The trust never had any kind of relationship with this tenant whatsoever. There's no privity. There were no payments made. There were no payments demanded. In fact, the trust did not even own this property until after the tenant had already moved out. So essentially, in 2007, the tenant sends a notice to the housing provider on June the 20th saying, I have already moved out of the property. At that point, the housing provider is the estate, and there's no dispute about that. In October of 2007, pursuant to the probate court, the estate deeds the property to the trust. So at the time the trust took ownership of this property, the tenant was already gone for 3 months. Given that, there's really no privity between the trust and the tenant that would convey liability. Further, I think it's extremely important that the trust, which took ownership after the tenant vacated the property, was not even suggested that they be made a party of this case, to this case, for 7 years. So it would be akin to a housing provider purchasing a house with nobody in it, and then getting sued 7 years later by a former tenant. There's just no relationship there, and it's improper for the trust to be a party. Now, the only basis that the tenant cites for the potential of the trust's liability in this case is section of the DC Code 423230. And I think, as the ALJ correctly stated in her most recent decision, that particular section of code is inapplicable to this situation. What that section of code establishes is that a successor tenant has the same right of action against the landlord, and vice versa. And we don't take issue with that. If a landlord is in possession, is in control of a property, is charging rent to a tenant, that tenant assigns his tenancy to another tenant, the assignment is otherwise acceptable as a matter of law, then the successor tenant has a right of action against the original landlord. We don't dispute that. But what that does not apply to is a situation where an original tenant moves out of a property and then tries to assert some liability as to a successor owner, not even a successor landlord, but a successor owner who took possession after the tenant moved out. There's simply no relationship there, and no statutory basis for any finding of liability whatsoever. And I think the ALJ, correctly noted that she did not intend to expand the statutory language, and that a plain reading of it made it clear that there was no extension to the trust in this particular case. As to the estate, I think, again, a closer look at the facts demonstrates that dismissal was proper in this particular context. And I think probably the most important fact that underscores our argument is that the tenant never made a claim against the estate. And that was our argument, the housing provider's argument. I wasn't counsel at the time, but that was the housing provider's argument in their second motion to dismiss, which was filed in March of 2008. Specifically, the housing provider argued that the deadline for filing claims against the estate with the probate court was May of 2007, and the tenant did not, by that deadline or at any time thereafter, file any claim against the estate. As such, the probate matter carried forward, and the assets of the estate were distributed, this property being one of them. And this property was distributed as per the will in October of 2007. The estate was closed by operation of law in 2009. And I think what the law is very clear on is that a closed estate is a legal nullity. It doesn't exist. A cause of action cannot be carried on against a closed estate. The hearing examiner also noted that on the record, Mr. Hessler, my co-counsel in this matter, in 2012 indicated that the personal representative had died. So even if the estate was not closed, at that point, the estate had no personal representative. And, you know, Mr. Gray tries to make an issue of the fact that there's no case law that says 2 years after a case is closed, they would have to amend and add the new personal representative. That's correct. There's no case that says that, but that's also not what we're saying. What we're saying is it's incumbent upon the tenant when pursuing a claim against an estate to have some idea of the status of the matter of the probate. And it's especially where the estate is represented by competent counsel, and a simple filing of a claim against the estate in the probate matter would have put the tenant on notice of everything that was going on in that case, and they could have pursued their claim. Not only would that have...
Was the tenant petition filed against the estate or against the individual who owned the property at the time?
It was filed against the estate.
Okay.
So the decedent passed in 2006. The estate was opened in late 2006, and notices sent in early of 2007. The tenant was present and paying rent to the estate from early 2007 through his departure in June of 2007. When the petition was brought, it was brought against the estate, but there was no claim filed in the probate court, which would have put them on notice of what was going on in the probate case. I think what should have happened in this case, that typically...
Under the Rental Housing Act, that he had that responsibility to file in the probate court.
Well, I think not only under the Rental Housing Act, I think if anybody's going to assert a claim against an estate, it has to be brought in the probate court as per Title 20 of the D.C. Code. So I don't think the Rental Housing Act... I agree that the Rental Housing Act doesn't create a special obligation that the tenant has to file a notice of claim in the probate court. But I think as a general matter, anytime anybody has any claim against an estate, they have to file a notice of that claim in the probate court. And if they don't, they risk happening precisely what happened in this case. The estate goes through the probate process, property gets distributed, and the tenant hasn't been able to stop the distribution of that property through the judicial process. They had options here. All they had to do was, if it was the tenant's contention that there was no personal representative,
file a motion to reopen the estate and have a representative appointed by the court, which is what happens when you pursue a claim against a closed estate. But if had they asserted a claim in the first place, the estate wouldn't have been closed. They didn't have to necessarily pursue this claim in probate court, but by filing notice of this claim in probate court, it would have given them the opportunity to at least keep the estate open or halt the proceedings or guarantee some possibility of recovery. But that's not what happened. In this case, the tenant on notice that this was an estate didn't file a claim in the probate court, and the probate case simply proceeded. The estate at this point is long closed, and I think the tenant would have a serious statute of limitations problem if they moved to reopen it, as they would have to do to either pursue this claim further or, if successful here and then successful again below, to try and collect on any judgment. I mean, again, the estate's simply a legal nullity at this point, so I don't know how it is that the tenant would be able to proceed against the estate without moving to have it reopened and having a substitute personal representative appointed. And I don't think there's any, likewise, I don't think there's any case that supports the tenant's position on this, and it is their burden.
Mr. Bianco, I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Yes.
Who is Lewis H. Kerr, Jr.?
Lewis H. Kerr, Jr. is the son of Lewis H. Kerr.
Okay, now he's listed as a trustee along with his mother.
Correct.
On ultimately the amended housing provider parties. So as a co-trustee, he's not a successor trustee, would he not have some responsibility related to the trust as it relates to this case?
Well, it's our contention that the trust has no responsibility related to this case. We're dealing with two different entities. We're dealing with an estate and we're dealing with a trust. The trust didn't assume ownership until after the tenant had vacated. So,
but the tenant filed before that was the issue.
The tenant filed against the estate. That's correct. The tenant never filed against the trust. The tenant did not raise any issue with regard to the trust until June of 2014. 7 years later.
Yes, so, but they did amend per the order from the ALJ.
They moved to amend, the ALJ granted the order, and then the ALJ vacated the order. And it's our contention that the ALJ in vacating the order was absolutely correct, because aside from a legal standpoint, heck, it's simply unfair to impose liability on a subsequent owner without notice after 7 years.
How could you say Mr. Kerr Jr. is without notice when he is a co-trustee?
Because Mr. Kerr Jr. had nothing to do with the estate, which was the party in interest at the time of filing. Nothing to do with it. He wasn't a beneficiary. He wasn't an executor. He wasn't an administrator. Wasn't a personal representative. Was unrelated completely, other than the fact that it was his father's estate. Mr. Kerr didn't have any legal connection to the estate. He's a co-trustee of the trust, sure. But
so he wasn't a beneficiary. We wouldn't know that unless we had a copy of the will, right?
That's correct, and that's not part of the record below.
But the trust holds the assets of the estate.
The trustees hold the real property. The personal representative is the legal owner for the period that the estate's the owner. So an estate, as the ALJ below cited, is not a natural person or an artificial person. The case cited by the ALJ was Benke versus Gieb, 169 F sub 647, which says an estate is merely a name. So the title is actually vested as a personal representative, which was Mrs. Kurd. So as PR, Mrs. Kurd title was vested in her. She collected the rent on behalf of the estate until the property was transferred to the trust, which was subsequent to the tenant moving out of the property.
Let me make sure I'm clear. At the time of Mr. Kurd's death, the trust existed, I assume.
The trust was not.
I just said existed. I didn't say.
The trust, as far as I know, did not exist at the time of Mr. Kurt's death.
Okay.
So the trust was a product of the will?
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Okay.
You have any further questions, Commissioner?
Not at this time.
If there's no further questions, I think in closing, there's one very important thing to look at that the administrative law judge pointed out, and it specifically goes to the issue of damages in a rental housing case. By regulation, specifically 14 DCMR 4200, the damages can only be imposed for improper rent being charged on somebody who has demanded or received those rental payments. The trust does not fit either of those definitions. They never received rent. They never asked for rent. In fact, they had not even become the owner of the property until after the tenant had moved out. So jurisdictional issues aside, from a simple practical damages claim, there is no way under the regs to impose liability on the trust.
Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, let me indicate to the court. The trust was, we're talking two things. When we use the word trust, we're talking about the subsequent purchaser or the transfer of the purse of the property and the estate. The only reason why I filed against the trust was because it was suggested. It does not matter to me because we're not really dealing with the trust in terms of damage issue. They did get the property after, through the transfer. But the real issue here is not that. The real issue is whether or not the personal representative, Louise Curry, had an obligation not to transfer that property. And under the code, the probate code, and I can't cite the exact number right now, if the personal representative is aware of a claim, they need to act on that claim, whether it's been submitted or not. And that six-month limitation does not comply, is not enforceable against the claimant, when in fact the personal representative knows there is an existing claim out there somewhere to be had. At the time that this was filed, we did not have a real basis for going to probate court because we didn't have a judgment. We didn't have anything saying they owe us money. But the personal representative knew that it was out there and knew it was a potential. Secondly, we're not asking this commission to say that the trust owes us anything. When we serve the personal representative, who is the owner of the property on behalf of the estate, that's who we were talking about. And she did not, well, the record doesn't show when she actually died except for statement by counsel. Nobody brought a death certificate in here and presented it. So in 2010, when we had that hearing, if we had gotten a judgment at that point, or at least an order saying this is how much you are owed, we could have taken it over the probate court, and I'm still not sure it's too late to do that, simply because the personal representative was aware of the claim before she transferred this property. And more importantly, it was a transfer between family members. Kurt Jr. collected rents on behalf of the estate as well as the mother. He was collecting it on behalf of the personal representative, and that might be somewhere in the record, because we presented evidence that he paid rent to a number of people on behalf of the estate. So I'm not concerned with whether or not the trust that later acquired the property is a party to this lawsuit or not. I'm only concerned with the fact that we sued the proper person and had this case come to an end prior to 2012, which it should have done, we would have been, we would have had our, at least a piece of paper saying, this is how much money you owe. If we then had taken it over to the Superior Court, we could have turned it into a form of judgment and filed a claim with probate. Because Ms. Kerr knew there was a paternity petition out there charging the estate that we were collecting or trying to collect on our ward here. We could only get that from here. We could not go to probate and get it. We could not go to the civil court and get it. Only through this agency could we collect. The only ones that could tell us whether or not we were entitled to any funds was this agency. And that's the Rental Accommodations Office. And therefore, we think that this case should have ended November 3rd, 2010.
Mr. Gray, the fact that the case was not ended in 2010 and did proceed for all the various reasons both of you have stated here today, you made the statement that the PR, you said the PR was the owner of the estate.
Of the fact that
we will make an assumption even right now that she is deceased, even though, as you point out, you don't have anything on the record. So if, in fact, she's deceased, she was the personal representative and no longer exists, who would you be suing if the PR no longer is with us?
We would go back to probate court and move to open it based on the knowledge that the personal representative has at the time that there were pending claim outstanding.
But no, for your tenant petition, what you do in probate court would be another action, which we have no authority over. But for this case that you're pursuing, you've made the statement that she was the owner, as I said, I'm making an assumption based on the discussion here that she's deceased. Who would you now be pursuing to get the refund that your party has claimed for?
I would go back and ask the court to appoint an administrator or PR to reopen this thing.
Questions?
No. I have not either.
Thank you, gentlemen, for appearing today.
Thank
you. Your case will be taken under advisement and decided as soon as it's practicable.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have one question. In your brief that you filed yesterday, Mr. Bianco, you say something to the effect of, I'm sorry, I don't have Ryan from me, attorney for Ms. Rodriguez.
May have been some bleed over from another meeting
okay,
I was working on, but
well, who is Ms. Rodriguez?
Right. I'm paging through right now to see if I can find
yeah.
it.
No, I don't see it. Oh, on page 6 it says respectfully submitted. And it just says at the very, yeah. Is that
yes,
bleed
I can
over?
Tell you. I,
okay, thank you.
I pasted my signature block from another pleading.
Okay. All right, I just, so yeah. Is there someone else here we're not aware
no.
of?
No.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Before y'all leave, could you wait out there and check the recording before you exit?
Sure.